The headlines: Russia calls on the UN Security Council to ask for an independent inquiry into the Nord Stream gas pipeline explosions. The White House says a contact between U.S. and Chinese militaries remains shut down as a senior American military official visits Taiwan. And the death toll from a massive earthquake that recently hit Turkey and Syria passes 45,000. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmati, and these are our top stories this hour. Russia wants the UN Security Council to ask for an independent inquiry into the Nord Stream gas pipeline explosions. Russia's representative to the UN has already submitted a draft resolution to the 15-member council. It asks the UN chief to establish an international investigation into the blasts and identify who was to blame. The U.S. and NATO have called the September incident an act of sabotage. Moscow has blamed the West, but neither side has provided evidence. But an American investigative journalist claimed last week that the U.S. Navy divers had destroyed pipelines with explosives. He said President Joe Biden personally issued the orders, an allegation that the White House has dismissed. And as the war continues to rage across the Donbass region, schools and kindergartens remain closed due to the fear that they might be hit by shelling. Johnny Miller sends us his report on how children on either side of the battle lines are being taught different versions of history.
Natasha, a kindergarten teacher in Donbass, she is teaching children at her home as the schools are closed. They're too often hit by Ukrainian shelling. Natasha's brother was killed last year fighting as a soldier. One of the boy's father has also been wounded at the front. What Natasha is teaching these kids reflects the views of the vast majority of people in Donetsk who are pro-Russian and blame Ukraine and the West for the war. Videos going around on social media of Ukrainian children being taught to hate Russians. Now, it's not clear how widespread that is, but what is clear is that Ukrainian children are being taught Ukrainian patriotic songs and nationalist history, and of course that the war is Russia's fault. Meanwhile, here in Donetsk, children are being taught a very different version of history. While the front lines continue to fluctuate on what was once governed as one country, a whole generation is now being brought up with conflicting world views and as two separate nations. Jenny Miller, Donetsk.
The U.S. and China are on a collision course with each other over a wide range of issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Tensions are now growing over the recent shooting down of a Chinese balloon in U.S. skies. Our news review program, we discuss this in length. Let's take a listen. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the U.S. says military channels with China are closed after a recent balloon episode elevated the tensions between the two countries to new highs. The spokesman for the White House National Security Council says, however, that diplomatic lines of communication remain open. Earlier this month, the U.S. shot down what it called a Chinese spying balloon that intruded into its airspace. Beijing slammed the move as an overreaction, saying it was a weather monitoring balloon that was blown off course. On Friday, the U.S. said that it had collected sensors and other debris from the balloon, and investigators were analyzing them. Even before the balloon incident, Beijing and Washington were at odds over a host of issues, including Taiwan, Hong Kong, and trade. Meanwhile, a senior U.S. military official reportedly visits Taiwan amid these tensions over the island. According to media reports, the U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Michael Chase is now in Taiwan, but this is yet to be confirmed by Taiwan's Defense Ministry and the Pentagon. Chase is the most senior U.S. military official to visit the self-ruled island since 2019. Separately, a U.S. bipartisan delegation is heading there this weekend to bolster ties with Taiwan's semiconductor industry. In response, China has urged the U.S. to stop meddling in the dispute with Taiwan. Beijing considers the island part of its territory and has repeatedly warned the U.S. against ties with Taiwan. To discuss that further, we're joined by Dr. Digby James Wern, a geopolitical analyst, and also Professor Yoichiro Sato Ritsukemen from the Asian Pacific University. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Let's begin with Dr. Wern. Now, these tensions are escalating even more right now, considering that we are hearing news from Taiwan that a U.S. military official is visiting there, although it has not been confirmed yet. But why do you think the U.S. is trying to rub China the wrong way?
Well, the U.S. is trying to rub China the wrong way all the time. There's nothing new there. But just 2 days ago, it was agreed that a Chinese mainland group would head to Taiwan at the invitation of the mayor of Taipei. And so I don't think it's any coincidence that those two visits are going to happen at approximately the same time. And of course, you know, the U.S. is in the process of expanding its bases in the Pacific. You know, there's problems in Australia with nuclear ambiguity. You know, the Australians, you know, not stating whether or not U.S. B-52s have nuclear weapons. You know, the nuclear submarines as well. I mean, so, you know, this is escalation right across the Pacific. And, of course, there's always the problems that are continuing in the Ukraine.
So, Professor Sato, in your opinion, how do you see these relations between China and U.S. developing?
Well, as you stated earlier, the relationship has been tense for the last couple of years already prior to the balloon incident, and the balloon shooting didn't make it any better. But having said that, it's not, you know, the when rubbing the other country in the wrong way, that's a kind of mutual tit for tat. That's how the tensions escalate. And the balloon incident came in the wrong timing when, you know, the Secretary Blinken was preparing for a visit to Beijing. And that was supposed to be an opportunity for the two countries to diffuse the ongoing tension. And there was plenty of reason why China, too, was looking for such an opportunity. China has been under the economic isolation because of the first pandemic, and also because of the political tensions with the United States and its allies and friends. And then China's support for the Russian invasion of Ukraine made things even worse. So China wanted to take a break from all these the diplomatic difficulties and try to diffuse the tension with the U.S., but somebody had to fly a balloon. So that tells something about, you know, the way Chinese government is operating. It's probably very disorganized on that side.
So back to Dr. Wern. In your opinion, what is going to happen next? I mean, we see the U.S. obviously trying to boost its military ties with Taiwan. China has time and again warned the U.S. not to do so. We've even had military exercises on the part of China taking place in that region.
Yeah, well, it's a red line. It's always been a red line, and it will always remain a red line. For China, there's never been any doubt about that, and so the U.S. knows what it's getting into, and I think it's fairly agreed now that you know, the U.S. is salami slicing the Shanghai communique, so its agreement over the one China principle, and that's just continuing, and one of the only things that the U.S. Congress can ever agree on is military spending and to have a foreign demon. So, you know, it's got Russia and China as foreign demons. Those security relationships are very much forward projection. One needs to always remember that the American power projection is all the way to China's near waters. It's not the other way around. There are no Chinese ships in California. So, you know, it's always going to be a red line. And China has always had a fairly measured response. The volatility of the balloon incident where, you know, those meteorological balloons, weather balloons, all sorts of surveillance balloons, there's hundreds and hundreds of these balloons floating around. And, you know, there was just news that the Americans had shot down some amateur balloonist's balloon. This is really a kind of a diversion.
Thank you very much, Professor Yoichiro Sato from the Ritsu Kamen Asian Pacific University, and also Dr. Degbe James, who are a geopolitical analyst. Thank you for joining us on this edition of the News Review. Moving on, in Turkey and Syria, grief is weighing heavily on people as the death toll from the massive earthquake that jolted the two countries on February 6th has now passed 45,000. Turkey has confirmed around 40,000 deaths, while the number of fatalities in neighboring Syria stands at over 5,800. The 7.8 magnitude earthquake and its aftershocks have also injured and displaced thousands more. Operations are underway to retrieve bodies from the rubble, as well as finding those who might have survived the catastrophe. However, many international rescue crews have left the vast earthquake zone, as the likelihood of pulling out people alive from the piles of wreckage is diminishing further and further. In a rare scene, however, three men were found alive in the Turkish province of Hatay on Friday after being trapped under the debris for 11 days. And at least 53 people are killed in an ambush in central Syria, which media are blaming on Daesh terrorists. The Syrian health official says 46 civilians are among the dead. The victims had gunshot wounds to their heads. Other details are sketchy. There is no claim of responsibility for the attack in the desert east of Homs, but the Daesh terror group has in the past killed or kidnapped many people in central, northeastern, and eastern areas of Syria. The latest such incident was on Saturday, when 16 people were reportedly killed by the terrorists. Remnants of Daesh are still active in parts of Syria after their defeat in 2018. The UN estimates the group maintains up to 10,000 terrorists in the country and neighboring Iraq. Earlier, we talked to our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, who gave us more detail about this tragic event.
According to Syrian state media, at least 53 people have been killed by Daesh terrorists in central Syria, particularly in close to Al-Sikhne town, which is southeast of Homs city. What we know is that according to the head of the Palmyra National Hospital, the 53 bodies arrived in that hospital, and he said, head of that hospital, that they were shot dead in the head. There were also five injuries that arrived to the same hospital. According to one of those injured as a result of this Daesh attack, Daesh terrorists also burned the vehicles and cars of the citizens who were actually over there in that part of Syria collecting desert truffles over there when the attack happened. It's important to point out that there are still sleeper cells of Daesh in Syria's desert, in Syria's central desert and the eastern parts of the country. And it's very important to say that perhaps all Syrians now, if you ask them on the streets, know that the reason why those terrorists still exist over there in Syria is because of the U.S. support to terrorist groups in that part of the country. We all know that the U.S. Occupation forces in eastern Syria, in a 10th, actually, illegal base, continue to support terrorist groups.
Several Latin American governments voiced their strong opposition to the Israeli plan to build more settlements in the occupied West Bank. In a joint statement, Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and Mexico said they are profoundly worried by Israel's decision, which they said would violate international law. Last week, Israel authorized 9 settlement outposts and pledged to construct new settler units in the occupied territories. Some Western countries also criticized the plan, saying any unilateral action would only exacerbate the tensions between Israelis and Palestinians. The new Israeli cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has stepped up its far-right agenda. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Militants have launched an attack on a police station in Pakistan's southern city of Karachi, killing at least 4 people, including 2 policemen. Gunfire and explosions broke out when the militants stormed the station that houses offices of the city's most senior police officers. The gun battle came to an end with all 3 attackers killed. The attack took place along the route to a stadium where the country's largest cricket tournament is being held. Pakistan's Tehrik-e-Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. The militant group has launched a series of attacks targeting police in Pakistan as part of its campaign against the government in Islamabad. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 27th of Rajab, the Feast of Mab'ath, which marks the formal appointment of Prophet Muhammad by God for guidance of mankind. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all Muslims throughout the world on this auspicious occasion.
The Grand Day of Mab'ath. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam everybody and heartiest felicitations to you all on one of the greatest days in history. Today, the 27th of the month of Rajab, is that glorious day, in the pre-dawn hours of which the one and only creator of the entire universe formally entrusted the universal mission for the guidance and salvation of all humanity to his last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. It is the day called Mab'ath, or Resurgence of Monotheism. It is the day foretold by all the prophets of the past. It is the day of the formal advent of Islam, which means peace, healthy way of life, and submission to none other than God, which was the theme of the messages of prophets of yore around the world since creation, became the formal name of the universal mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Before we present you a special program on this auspicious day, here is Ayah 157 of Surah A'raf. Those who follow the messenger, prophet, the Ummi, are not taught by any human, whose mention they find written with them in the Torah and the Evangel, who bids them to do what is right and forbids them from what is wrong, makes lawful to them all the good things and forbids them from all vicious things, and relieves them of the burdens and shackles that were upon them. Those who believe in him, honor him, and help him, and follow the light that has been sent down with him, they are the felicitous. We are celebrating the anniversary of one of the greatest days in history. This enlightening event took place on Mount Nur at the cave of Hira outside Mecca on 27th of Rajab, when Archangel Gabriel descended with the first rays of divine revelation to the 40-year-old Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Here are ayahs 1 to 7 of Surah Alaq, which set in motion the revelation of the entire Quran over the next 23 years as the final and most comprehensive heavenly scripture for the guidance and salvation of all human beings. Read in the name of your Lord who created man from a clinging mass. Read. And your Lord is the most generous, who taught by the pen, taught man what he did not know. Thus, as is clear, the formal ordainment of the Prophet of Islam occurred in the full limelight of recorded history. It was unlike the ordainment of the prophets of the past, such as Jesus, Moses, Abraham, Noah, and the countless others whom the one and only Creator had raised in different eras and different parts of the globe, with emphasis on preaching monotheism, virtue, social justice, and all humanitarian values. The raising of the last and greatest prophet was foretold by God Almighty in the Evangel, the Torah, and the previously revealed heavenly scriptures, as well as in religious texts of the Zoroastrians, the Hindus, and others. Parts of these prophecies are still preserved in spite of the tampering by interlopers that these books have gone through. For instance, in chapter 18, verse 15 of Deuteronomy, we read the prophecy to Moses, "I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, Ishmaelite Arabs, like unto thee, and will put my words into his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command him. And it shall come to pass that whosoever will not hearken unto my words which he shall speak in my name." In the Gospel of St. John, chapter 18, verses 7 to 14, we find the following prophecy of Prophet Jesus. "I have yet many things to say unto you, but you cannot bear them now. How be it when he, the Spirit of Truth, the Comforter, is come, he will guide into all truth, for he shall not speak of himself, but whosoever he shall hear, that shall he speak, and he will show you things to come. He shall glorify me, for he shall receive of mine, and shall show it unto you. These prophecies about the Prophet of Islam are not limited to Abrahamic religions, but are also found in the holy books of other religions. For instance, in the Dasatir and Zend Avesta of Zoroastrians, we read, "A man will appear from among the Arabs before whose followers crown, throne, kingdom, and religion shall be overthrown, and arrogant people will be subjugated. Instead of the house of idols and the temple of fire, they will look at the house of worship of Abraham without any idols in it and will make it their focal point of worship, qibla." It is also interesting to note that the books of Hindus such as Kalki Purana and Kalki Avatar have also mentioned the advent of the Prophet of Islam. His name will be Muhammad. People will be astonished to see his style, and he will not worship as the people of his tribe will be worshipping idols, and he will tell the people that I have been told by that Almighty and one God not to indulge in such senseless worship, and I am not turning but to the Lord Most High, therefore you shall follow me. In Ayah 21 of Surah Ahzab, God Almighty says, "In the Prophet of Allah, certainly there is for you an excellent exemplar. For those who look forward to Allah and the last day and remember Allah greatly." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was thus the finest example of a perfect man in every sense of the term. He was a paragon of virtue and the most excellent exemplar for the human race. The Almighty distinguished him from all others by instilling in his sublime personality such fine qualities as modesty, truthfulness, kindness, patience, loyalty, honesty, courage, bravery, generosity, magnanimity, wisdom, and the like. By studying his lofty characteristics and the amazingly simple life that he led with his household, companions, wives, and others, we are able to learn valuable lessons from his conduct and accordingly mold our own lifestyle. Our society could never be an Islamic one unless we sincerely tread the footsteps of Allah's final messenger to all world people, heed his sayings, and emulate his practice and behavior, that is, Sunnah and Sirah, as the faithful among his companions did. This means to desist from whatever he has forbidden and obey whatever he has bequeathed to us. The most important point to note is that the event of Mab'ath took place in the presence of a witness who has related it precisely in the flawless manner in one of his flawlessly eloquent sermons, which also inform us of the loud moan of Satan, who became dismayed forever about the success of his deceit. The witness was none other than the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, who, as a 10-year boy, used to take food and clothing to his 40-year cousin on Mount Nur during the days of solitude the latter would spend at the cave of Hira, the person whom the Prophet, by express commandment of God, formally proclaimed as vicegerent on the plain of Qadir Khum on 18th of Dhul-Hajjah in 10 AH, 23 years after Mab'ath, says in Sermon 191 of Nahjul Balagha, "When I was only a child, he took charge of me. I used to follow him like a young camel following in footprints of its mother. Every day he would show me some of his high traits and commanded me to follow it. Every year he used to go into seclusion to the Mount of Hira, where I saw him but no one else used to see him. I used to see and watch the effulgence of divine revelation and message and breathe the scent of prophethood. When the revelation descended on the Prophet of Allah, I heard the moan of Satan. I asked, 'O Prophet of Allah, what is this moan?' He replied, 'This is Satan, who has lost all hope of being worshipped. O Ali, you see all that I see, and you hear all that I hear, except that you are not a prophet, but you are a vicegerent.'" By reflecting on these undeniable facts, we understand that adherence to the path of the seal of messengers is not complete unless the believers follow the footsteps of his divinely designated heir, Imam Ali, peace upon him, as well as the 11 other infallible imams of his progeny, the last of whom is in occultation by the will of God, and will reappear in the end times as Mahdi al-Qa'im, to establish the global government of peace, prosperity and justice by ridding the planet of all vestiges of corruption and oppression. That is the reason we are advised to perform the special ziyarat of Imam Ali, peace upon him, in Najaf on the grand day of Mab'ath, and if travel is not possible, to recite it by turning towards the direction of Najaf from whatever we happen to be.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Protests over food and fuel, not something usually associated to Europe or Western countries, but that is not the case anymore, for it looks like it has become the norm. Protests have surged in Europe, like in France, where the French protested against pension reform, similar to protests in Spain, Germany, and can't forget the UK. But at the heart of these protests is a sentiment of insecurity that people are feeling, and that's over the cost of living as a whole. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how long this crisis will last for Europe, and for how much longer will the politicians of these countries divert funds to things like the Ukraine conflict instead of their own people. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Keith Pilbeam, professor of international economics and finance at City University, joins us from London. Also joining us from London is Robert Ulz, executive director at Impact International.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Robert Ulz, I'll first start with you. What is going on in Europe when you take a look at protests for basically the cost of living? I'm starting out with a general question because this is what the stat reads, that there was an unprecedented global wave of more than 12,500 protests across 148 countries, okay, as a whole, not just Europe. We're talking as a whole. And that's over food, fuel, and the cost of living increases. This was recorded for the year 2022. But the largest ones were in Western Europe. Why is that?
Well, Western European countries were running an economic model which was basically built upon cheap labour keeping wages low. So there was the suppression of labour. There was also the easy supply of money. Interest rates were kept low and government spending and borrowing was high. But that created inflationary pressures. Now, we had that inflationary pressures came to bear with, of course, the mass printing of money that came with the measures to relieve the COVID problems, which were, of course, generated mainly by actually the lockdowns which were put in place. And the governments were throwing out money. That was always going to create inflation. Now, of course, add in the increased cost of fuel and gas as a result of the Ukraine conflict. And then, of course, the profiteering from energy companies and in a situation where people's wages were already artificially kept low. Then, of course, we have people in real economic difficulties, low wages, high cost of living. There's only one thing that's going to happen there, and that's going to be further economic problems. But also, politically, it will mean there will be protests. So that's where we are now. Really, it's a result of policies which go back a long time in history, many decades, where, of course, inflation was artificially low because of unit labour costs in the Chinese economy, and they could supply products at a very low rate, and that artificially looked like inflation was low. But, of course, actually, places like Britain, house prices were shooting up because the government, when it was artificially producing money, printing money, creating it out of thin air in many cases, that just in a sense created a situation, a world where house prices and asset costs were shooting up, but people's wages were not keeping up. And so, of course, there's always going to be a situation where the situation would fail and people would then protest. And that's what we're seeing now.
All right. Well, if you want to take a look at this overall, Keith Pilbeam, I think our guest there, Robert Ulz, painted, I'm guessing, an accurate picture, and we could just wrap up this program and call it the night or the day, wherever you may be. But let's get into some of the countries and see where things stand. For example, in France, we're looking at a fifth day of these nationwide strikes. It's about these pension reform, retirement age, or pension reform, which wants the retirement age to increase from 62 to 64. Now, I'm guessing also at the heart of this, we're looking at a cost of living that people are obviously coming out to relay their sentiments on that. What are we looking at when we're taking a look at France, in this case in point?
Well, what we're looking at in the West, actually, as well as France, is aging populations and whether governments can continue to support you into your old age with a generous pension. And let's be honest, in France, they're raising it from 62 to 64. But in the UK, for example, we're raising it from 65 to 68. So it's a different ballgame. So in some ways, the French are behind. But the reality is that the welfare state in the West has grown excessively large and it's not sustainable and public finances are not sustainable. It's absolutely clear that there is a very rich, people have become very rich, some of them, and other people haven't done very well, okay, which is the many in a way. And ultimately, this is about income distribution from the rich to the others, because that's the position we're in. And it's a common problem across, you know, the G7 economies, I would say, not just France, UK. United States has got a demographic problem as well, not to the same extent, though. So the question is reality. And I think the solution will be targeting. You see, there's no need to give multimillionaires that own lots of land and whatever pensions, to be honest. We've got to relook at universal benefits because it's unsustainable, the current system. It's as simple as that. And governments have to actually decide how to allocate money, which is scarce.
All right.
And they seem incapable of doing that.
So you're targeting universal, expenditure there. But I get the feeling that you're just focusing on that. But how about having the government increase its revenue through other means, not just, for example, taxes, but generate revenue, whether it's investments in the country or what have you? Are European countries lacking that confidence in just one example that I just stated?
Well, public finances are tight because, as your previous speaker said, they borrowed lots of money and a lot of it was wasted, of course. This is the worst thing. When they borrowed huge amounts for COVID, so much of it was wasted on excessively generous furlough schemes in many countries.
Right.
They were excessively generous. They stopped people working in order to qualify for COVID. I mean, it's a completely stupid thing to do. PPE equipment, well, wasted. Lots of money was wasted. People could have gone back to work much quicker, yeah, with proper protections. So there was tens of billions wasted.
Okay.
And that's the problem. You haven't got that money now, you see,
nope.
Because we've already spent it. We've already increased the national debt. And we printed, as your previous speaker said, far too much money. And that's now causing inflation. It was fantasy land. You can pay for everything by printing money, and that's going to do good for the economy. It's fantasy economics, always has been, and always will be.
All right, Robert Olds, to round up France, if you can please give us your idea as to what's going to happen in that country. We're looking at the reform that Emmanuel Macron wants to push through to raise that retirement age from 62 to 64. We're still looking at a cost of living crisis somewhat in that country. And, of course, we're looking at what France, just like many other countries, had a furlough screen that was very generous. But moving forward, how is it going to be able to deal with this? I mean, he himself has come out and said that if we don't get this reform in place, the government's going to have a very tough time trying to meet its obligations in terms of its budget or what have you. I'm trying to look at what Emmanuel Macron has said. So what are your thoughts on France?
Well, the French are not afraid to protest. They never have been, in fact, have a history of doing so. So there's protests, there's strikes, even more than what's in the UK. There are measures in France to try and restrict the strikes, and of course the protests, and in some cases there can be some quite brutal policing. But the French still will take to the streets. There was originally the Yellow Vest movement in France, which was driven by Emmanuel Macron, the president, putting up taxes, particularly on fuel, and really targeting the middle class people in France, people who are, in a sense, those who are the squeezed middle, as we would call them in the UK, those who are not poor enough and or destitute enough to be reliant on benefits, but then not wealthy enough to be able to afford higher taxes. And so they've been squeezed, they've been pushed around, they've been really squeezed till the pip itself squeaked, to coin a phrase. Now, what we're going to see in France is further problems. Their economy possibly will grow over 2023, but at a very low rate. It's probably Germany is the only significant country in Europe that will be suffering a recession. Britain is thankfully out of the recession, but France is going to have more and more difficulties, and really they won't be able to have, there isn't the political headroom in France for people to tolerate any more measures, such as reducing the state pension, or indeed increasing the age at which people qualify for the pension in France. Uh-huh. That will be met with protests. People will just not tolerate it. So there's going to be some severe economic difficulties. But to come to the UK, yes, there are problems. There is the cost of living crisis in Britain, which has largely been driven by higher fuel costs. But at the same time, Centrica, the company that owns British Gas and supplies much of gas to British homes, has made record profits. There is a problem here of an economic model which is not really a free market. It's rent-seeking companies, corporations who need to be broken up, monopolies that need to be smashed, cartels that need to be broken, just like Teddy Roosevelt did in the United States in the early 20th century. That's what needs to happen here, because there's not competition. And so companies are just at will to put their prices up. We need to have some monopolies broken here and some cartels smashed.
Good point.
And to have a re-energized economy, which is competitive, which has a real free market and has consumers having to have choices, not companies exploiting their unfortunate customers.
Sure. Keith Bilbin, our guest talks about an economic model there. I think it's called greed, and if you want to really round it up. But it has been termed as greedflation in terms of the corporate profits that are being made. And, of course, the whole idea about this monopoly is something that has been discussed. I'm sure you're well aware of that. Record profits raked in by these companies. First, why weren't they stopped? Why were they? Has it been successful? And how much of a difference would that make, the impact would have on the cost of living in the case of the UK, for example?
Well, the government has imposed taxes, windfall taxes on these firms. And, you know, they're going through good times at the moment, but a few years ago, price was a lot lower and they weren't making profits. So I don't think you can have it both ways. We need to have a system that is fair and equitable over time. So they're having good times at the moment, but this is due to the surge, all right? So it's not necessarily corporate greed, and windfall taxes also send the wrong message, because it means, you know, if you're successful, make loads of money, we'll suddenly impose windfall taxes, which is not what you want. But this government is pretty incompetent in the way it basically manages virtually any issue. And so I don't agree that, you know, these windfall profits should necessarily something to worry about, because as that price is coming down, and we've seen that in the wholesale, those profits will come down automatically with it.
Okay.
But of course, it doesn't sit well with people when they're suffering the biggest fall in living standards, you know, since the Second World War. I mean, and Britain is not in a good state. We've narrowly avoided a technical recession. But we've also got the additional burden of Brexit, which is wasted money in the hundreds of billions. It's in the hundreds of billions.
Right.
And of course, that's leaving less money for public finances. A smaller economy means smaller tax take. And that means you have to be tougher with the state workers.
Okay.
So we're in a complete mess. Any idea that we're in any better shape than Germany is delusional.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Robert Ault, if you have a response there to our guest, Keith Bilbin.
Well, the wholesale gas price has actually come down. It actually came down in the autumn quite substantially, yet cost reductions were not passed on to consumers. Companies, because they could get away with it, because people find it hard to switch and because there isn't really much choice, and because energy companies really do, it seems, operate as if they are in a cartel, the energy companies didn't pass on the savings to their consumers, who of course now are still having to pay a high amount for energy. So really, that's the situation where we have. And when it comes to Brexit, well, actually, British inflation in terms of food prices is actually lower than that in the Eurozone, and actually lower than that in the EU. So really, there hasn't actually been this economic harm done by Brexit. In fact, quite the reverse. It's Germany that is in recession.
Okay.
Britain has just about narrowly
avoided. Let's talk about Germany.
It. And we'll, of course, bounce along the bottom for the 2023. But from 2024 onwards,
all right,
we should actually see some growth returning.
I know that Brexit, and I saw your reaction, Keith Bilbin, we just really have to cover Europe. I don't want to be stuck in the UK. So let's move on to, and I'd like both of you to obviously have your input on Germany, because Robert Ault there, Keith Bilbin, talks about how Germany is going to go into a recession, unlike other European countries. But Germany is the EU's powerhouse. How much of an effect, an impact will that have on the EU as an organization? And of course, why is that? Do you agree?
Well, Germany has been much more affected by the rise in oil and gas prices. It's actually got a much bigger manufacturing sector, for starter, and a much bigger dependence on Russian oil and gas, and has had to seek replacements at world prices, much more severely affected than Britain. So you can't conclude anything about the inflation, because, of course, it's going to be bigger in Germany as a result of, a much more dependence on oil than the UK and gas. So we can't make those kind of comparisons. And Germany, of course, is also stuck in this sort of manufacturing. It is not moved to become the service sector economy like the UK. So it's got its own problems, and also lacks, the investment that is needed, really. Look at the US economy. It's been doing pretty well throughout all of this crisis. Doing pretty well on economic growth, because they're in growth sectors. They've got all these service sector companies that are still doing well, technology and stuff. And Germany, to be honest, has not been doing as well as it used to. I mean, that's it. It's also had the additional burden, of course, of, levelling incomes across Germany between the East and the West.
All right. So, Robert Ault, here we are. We're looking at inflation of the European Union at a record number at 11.5%. At the same time, real wages have fallen behind. Based on one particular source, maybe this source is stretching it, but it says that in every EU member state this year, it's referring to the year 2022, that it was by as much as 9% for real wages to have fallen. I'm not too sure how accurate that is, but it kind of gives an idea of how bad things are. It's all about wages and how they have not kept up with the pace of inflation. So what is there to do? Is there a one-size-fit-all answer that we can give here, or should each economy of these European countries be looked at differently?
Well, when it comes to the European Union, yes, there is this cost of living crisis across the whole of Europe. There's also another problem. It's not just about energy prices affecting the German economy, although that is indeed very significant. You had Germans actually taking to the woods to collect wood for to use in firewood, because they couldn't actually afford to be paying the electricity and gas costs. There's another problem as well, and that's a lack of creativity, a lack of inventiveness, and lack of competitiveness, and just really using the European institutions to make the rules that restrict new entrants coming into the marketplace. just to reward the big, powerful corporations that are already in place. And Germany benefited from that from quite a long time, but they're paying the price now because Germany bet very heavily, German manufacturers bet heavily on diesel, for instance. Well, that technology is now outmoded and politically unacceptable
and
socially unacceptable as well. But there isn't really a big European electric car maker. It just doesn't exist. There's China, there's the United States.
Let me jump in here, Robert. Sorry for jumping in. I got to squeeze in this question for Keith Bilbing because we're just almost out of time. Keith Bilbing, in under a minute, we're looking at France. The union has said we'll bring the country to a standstill with our protests. We're looking at the UK. Another strike action is going to take place in the coming week, along with all the other ones that keep increasing in numbers. How are the respective governments of these countries feeling the danger of people power? And is there a threshold that may be passed will be too late for the government to deal with the people coming out of masses? Less than a minute, please.
Well, in both countries, the governments can make further concessions. Ultimately, there is more money that can be borrowed. And if that helps through the crisis, then that's what they'll end up doing. But they do need to think of other policies as well. Wealth taxes should be very high on the agenda because, you know, we've got the state in a very bad financial state and yet very
wealthy. We need growth. That's what we need, growth and creativity and companies that respond to their consumers and the public rather than just exploit the population.
Thank you. We're going to have to end it there, Robert Ulls. We appreciate that. Executive Director at Impact International. And Keith Bilbing, thank you, Professor of International Economics and Finance at City University, both from London. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikabe Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though, we learn...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip, what is one of the things that happens when we do our ubudiyah and it is done in a sincere manner? So, dear friends, we are talking about one of the effects which happens to us when our ubudiyah, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah is accepted by the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, the acceptance of our ubudiyah has certain effects. But on the other hand, there's a caveat, and that is that we must always remember and keep in mind the possibility that our ubudiyah is not accepted by the Almighty Allah. Some people might become proud, or they might become arrogant in thinking that their ubudiyah and their servitude and their worship and their obedience to the Almighty Allah is accepted.